Hello, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome back to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book entitled Pappy Land, a story of family, fine bourbon, and the things that last, written by Wright Thompson. You know, it's pretty funny that this is the day that we are recording this podcast about Pappy Van Winkle, the legendary bourbon, and we'll talk all about it today. But this morning, over coffee, I was just scrolling through Instagram, and one of my favorite bartenders from one of my favorite and one of the country's greatest cocktail bars here in Chicago posted a little meme on social media on her Instagram stories. And it's hard to explain a meme over a podcast, but I've done it before. I'll do it again. And it's basically a picture of two runners, and the runner behind is trying to catch the runner ahead, reaching out. And there's a real anguish, pained look on the face of the runner in front. And she captioned it, "Hey, bro, you have any Pappy?" And it's just this constant struggle because this is basically a cult bourbon. If you're not familiar with it, you're about to be. And if you are familiar with it, this book would definitely give you a lot more insight, but it is highly sought after, it's highly expensive, and at least once a week, somebody is hitting up the bartenders at the aviary to see if, bro, you've got some Pappy. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, STUDYHALL, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. So about this book. So this is a new publication. It came out in 2020, and Wright Thompson is a senior writer for ESPN. He is from the South. He lives in Oxford, Mississippi with his family. And, you know, it's interesting. I was not familiar with him before, but he's an excellent writer. This is such a good storyteller. This is a really quick, fast read. It's like 244 pages. It's a hardback book. And the jacket, the dust jacket, is just the picture of a bunch of bourbon barrels. And the way the title is indicated on the book, it looks like it's actually been branded onto one of the ends of the bourbon barrels. So it's a new book. It's divided roughly into three parts. And originally the idea of this book was that Wright Thompson, the author, would be writing about Julian Van Winkle III, who is, you know, the head of the family, and it's his family, the Van Winkle family, that oversaw the formation, the dissolution, and the resurrection of the Pappy Van Winkle bourbon brand. Now, I don't know if anyone out there is familiar with Pappy Van Winkle. I think you probably are. And a lot of people have like Pappy stories. I was just talking to my producer as we were starting to record, and she just had her first Pappy Van Winkle experience recently. And I actually remember with a little bit of chagrin, one of my first Pappy Van Winkle stories. I'm going to date myself a little bit here, not in a flattering way, but years ago when I was in Washington, D.C., working as a sommelier in a restaurant and was friends with the chef of the restaurant. And for his birthday, I wanted to do something nice for him. And this was pre the, you know, the cult status of Pappy Van Winkle. If you knew, you knew, but it wasn't to the point where it is now. And so I bought him a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle. That's a nice gift. Now, to put this in perspective, it was like $100. So I think it was the 10-year-old Pappy, or maybe it's like 15-year, but it wasn't the 23-year-old, which, by the way, Fitch is about $5,000 per bottle on the market now, if you can find it. So the price has certainly skyrocketed, but I thought that that was a very thoughtful gift. I like to be a thoughtful giver of gifts, and it was certainly appreciated, but it broke my bourbon-loving heart just a little bit when he told me a couple weeks later that he'd had some friends over and they killed the bottle doing shots one night. Oh, it still pains me a little bit to hear that. And you know what? The only thing that kind of mollifies my pain is that I hope at some point he understood how wonderful that elixir was and how maybe it could have been savored a little bit more. So this book, as I mentioned, is divided up into three parts. And it's such a good book, and it covers all aspects of bourbon. So, you know, this is an informative podcast, so we gotta start with the basics. So bourbon, of course, is a type of whiskey, and there are lots of types of whiskeys. And so all bourbon is a whiskey, but not all whiskey is a bourbon. Many people think that bourbon has to come from Kentucky. It's not true. It does not, though the majority of bourbon produced in the United States does come from Kentucky. It can be made anywhere within the United States. And what defines bourbon as a style of spirit is what you make it from. You know, whiskeys are made from distillation of fermented cereal grains. And so by law, bourbon has to be at least 51% corn. Now, the other 49% of what the cereal grains that make it up are up to the distiller. So the most common second ingredient is rye, followed by barley. And as is described in this book, that's not true for all bourbons. And Pappy Van Winkle, along with Maker's Mark and a few other bourbons, actually use wheat as their secondary cereal grain. And that creates a different flavor profile. Now, in my not so copious spare time, I also teach spirits classes for the WSET. And when we're talking to folks about spirits, one of the things to understand about what determines the flavor profile of a given spirit, there's four things we consider: the raw material. So when it comes to bourbon, we're talking about the mash bill, the blend of grains that are being used. It has to be 51% corn, can be more. And then what are the other grains? And then that starch in those grains has to be converted into fermentable sugar. And then the fermentation process creates flavors depending on the strain of yeast and other variables. And then once you have fermentable sugars, you can create an alcohol. Basically, when we're making whiskey, we're essentially creating a beer. And then the distillation process concentrates the alcohol in that beer, or if we were talking about cognac, in that wine, to create an actual spirit. So raw material, fermentation, distillation, and then what happens after distillation. And in the case of bourbon, the whiskeys, when they come off the still, they are colorless. They're completely dry. They're very powerful. They're highly alcoholic. And there's required aging by law for bourbon in new charred American white oak casks. Now, there's other American whiskeys, and, you know, Tennessee whiskey is similar, but, you know, there's a few key components and a few key differences. But as long as you dot your I's and you cross your T's and you follow all the laws regarding bourbon production, et voila, you've got your bourbon. And the Van Winkle family, it's detailed, and I won't necessarily recount all of it here, but Julian Van Winkle's grandfather established the family company. And then it was passed on to his father, who, for various reasons, very sad reasons, probably one of the things that, you know, that ended up leading to his death, you know, sort of the shame and the heartbreak, but lost the family distillery. And then Julian, who grew up in this family industry, was able to purchase back some of the old family barrels of bourbon and start a new label. And now, along with his son, is actually making new whiskey at the Buffalo Trace Distillery. So it kind of follows this family timeline. But the book opens, before I go any further, I'll say that I have had the good fortune once to meet Julian Van Winkle. I was in Louisville, Kentucky a couple years ago for, it was actually a sommelier event, but we had the good fortune to do a tasting and have a panel of multiple bourbon distillers. Julian Van Winkle was one of, you know, four, and he is certainly not just revered and probably worshipped by many, but he's also highly regarded by his peers. He seems like a super cool guy, and honestly, this book made me think 100% he's a super cool guy. Anyway, it begins at the Kentucky Derby. And I've never been to the Kentucky Derby, but the first page of this book really sheds a light into the just the talented writing of Wright Thompson. And just it sets a scene so perfectly. So you'll have to indulge me. So the author, Wright Thompson and Julian Van Winkle III, are at Kentucky Oaks, or at Churchill Downs, rather, the day before the Derby, and they make their way through the crowd, and it's described as a crowd of people with a sheen on their faces and seersucker stuck to their thighs. I thought of an old friend who once said that existing at our latitude felt like living inside someone's mouth. Now, that might sound really gross, but it sets a scene very well, because obviously seersucker, that traditional and breathable fabric that many people outfit themselves throughout the South is certainly worn a great deal at horse races. But the humidity, the heat and the humidity, one of my favorite descriptions for really hot, sticky, humid weather is just saying it feels close. Everything feels close. But existing at that latitude feels like existing in someone's mouth. And if it makes you giggle, then, you know, you're like automatically hooked in on this book. You know, one thing that you can't escape throughout this entire book, and I really appreciate how deftly the author addresses it, is the really horrific, troublesome, racist traditions in the South and how you can't escape them. And he describes how he went to Ole Miss and the band used to always play Dixie, and he would both feel nostalgic about it, but he would always wince about it. And he called it the duality of Southern living. There are aspects of living in the South that can be, you know, charming and beloved. And then there's also horrible aspects of living in the South. And he acknowledges both and how complicated it is to experience and be aware of all of those aspects. So it's both a funny and a really interesting start to the book. The first chapter describes how Julian and Wright are kind of making their way through the Derby and kind of meeting folks and kind of taking in the whole scene. And when we get into chapter three, it's sort of These are short chapters. I should say that sometimes they're like two pages long, two or three. The book is divided into three parts, but it has the effect of making this a really fast read. So when I say that they're still at the Derby in chapter three, it's only 12 pages past the beginning of the book. As they're making their way through the crowd, it's just basically described as the Derby is just a shit show. And that Friday of the Derby weekend used to be the locals' favorite, the Friday before the actual race. And now that's been pushed to Thursday. And so many tourists now come to Kentucky Oaks that the real local time at the track is Thursday, so much that it's called Kentucky Thurby. And so it's just kind of this cute, like, insider knowledge that, you know, obviously there's tons of tourists and it's a huge, huge draw, but the locals always seem to know, like, the place and the time to go. And I just thought that was kind of clever and kind of cute. One of the things that this book does in such a very effective way is it paints a tale on the history of whiskey production in the United States and why certain things are the way they are. Going back to the times of, you know, Washington and Jefferson and the Whiskey Rebellion and why so much corn is produced in Kentucky and what that led to being the sort of the bourbon heart of the United States in terms of production. It's got the right climate and environment. And then what led to the actual production of spirits and other local goods is that the evolution and the evolution of the production of these spirits really came all about from farmers, and creating a spirit from their agricultural crops was a way to ensure cash flow, but also that nothing went to waste. So if you didn't have the means to transport or market your crops, whether we're talking about, you know, rye, barley, wheat, or corn, and you have a surplus, you can either feed it to animals, let it rot, or you can make something out of it. And of course, the precursor to really bourbon and any kind of, but particularly bourbon, but any kind of spirit we might call White Dog, because when the spirit comes off the still, it's you know, really powerful, but it's also completely clear. But that's also called moonshine, depending on if you are legally producing it. And you know, if you're familiar with or have spent some time in parts of the rural South, moonshine production, you may have even had some. It usually finds its way to you in a mason jar. It's a traditional vehicle, but it's a legally produced, non-taxed whiskey. And there is definitely a feeling, at least as described in this book, of many Kentuckians, that the taxing on or whiskey was basically treated as currency and oftentimes traded to avoid government taxes associated with it, which is why the IRS has long been concerned with chasing down moonshiners and bootleggers. And that to Kentuckians, this is a federal war on working rural families, no matter what happens in Washington. That's an interesting perspective to take, no doubt. But this has been a long, long industry, and it's certainly have some very colorful characters indeed. One thing as the story progresses, going from a history and academic standpoint, it always comes back to Julian and Wright. And this book takes place over a couple of years, just about their time spent together. And it's partially a biography. It's partially a history of whiskey, but it always kind of just hops back and forth in a very gentle manner. But it also intersperses little vignettes and stories about the author's own family. And that's one thing that he talks about with bourbon specifically, is how so much of it is, you know, intertwined with this idea of tradition and nostalgia. And he talks about his family, his wife, and their attempts to to start a family, and the death of his father, and you know, his family life growing up in the South, and then comparing that to the Van Winkle family, which he spends a lot of time with them, not just Julian, but you know, Julian's wife, Sissy, and they have four children. They have a son, Preston, who works with Julian now, and triplet daughters, and their daughters and at least one of their son-in-laws are also involved in the family business. And so it's this story of this family. But one thing I really like, and this comes up throughout the entire book, is the Van Winkle motto for bourbon. And it's always fine bourbon. We make fine bourbon at a profit if we can, at a loss if we must, but always fine bourbon. And that's sort of the driving factor with this quest of Julian Van Winkle III to kind of reclaim the family industry, because the style of bourbon that his grandfather created, and his grandfather seemed to be a pretty estimable guy, was a really distinct and different style than a lot of other bourbons being produced. And so it was, you know, a real family tragedy that due to circumstances and finances, that his father was forced to sell off the company. And essentially what happened is a large beverage conglomerate purchased the distillery and purchased all of the contents from his grandfather and father's distillery, the Stitzel Weller Distillery. And then through a series of, you know, hard work and good fortune, that global beverage conglomerate still had a stock of those Stitzelweller barrels of bourbon. And they called Julian Van Winkle and asked if he would be interested in buying them at some crazy price, like $200 a barrel. And he scrambled to put together the finances. And so he was able to actually buy back some of the original family stock that gave him the sort of the ability and the leg up to kind of rebuild the family business. So I was mentioning early on how this has become such a cult favorite. And, you know, there's a couple different reasons why. There's always sort of a boom and a bust with bourbon. Brown liquor has its devotees and also people who really don't like it. And it's a particular flavor profile. I really like it. I've always been a bourbon drinker. And this book helped me understand actually even more about the spirit and why I prefer certain brands over others, because obviously it's all about Pappy Van Winkle, but there is a lot of discussion about other bourbons and other bourbon distilleries. And so it does help you kind of get a little bit more of a granular look at about competitor bourbons, as it were. But I mean, with that anecdote that I was telling about the bottle of bourbon that I gave to my chef, you know, the price of these spirits have just gone through the roof because the brand basically didn't exist for a while. And one of the things that drives prices, you know, sky high or low is supply and demand. So when supply is super low and demand starts to increase, prices are eventually going to increase and people start to fetishize it. And there are some really, really funny stories. I mean, one of my favorites is in chapter 14, and the author writes, "I love being with Julian or his son Preston in a bar that fetishizes bourbon." I'm just going to have to read here because this is just too good. So sadly, I wasn't there for the best bourbon fetish bar moment. Once in New York, Preston leaned against a bar and ordered a Van Winkle, how he drinks it, as Julian drinks it, as Julian Jr. and Pappy drank it, on the rocks with a twist. So that's just bourbon poured over ice with a twist of lemon. And the bartender snootily told him that he didn't feel right serving such fine bourbon like that. Preston grinned. He paused for dramatic effect and then delivered the kill shot. "Well, sir, that sure is disappointing, given that's how my grandfather and father taught me to drink it, and my family made the stuff after all. Hi, I'm Preston Van Winkle." When I heard that story, I laughed at a hipster getting a lesson that bourbon is supposed to be a vehicle and not a destination. When a bourbon nerd friend heard it, though, he got angry at Preston for disrespecting someone's passion, which I do not understand at all, but trust him enough to take seriously. There's a few different stories like this. One, to be a fly on that wall. Must have been amazing. And I love how it's described as the kill shot, because he just pauses, smiles, and destroys. But it is sort of this interesting thing that, like, you know, and we see this in the wine industry all the time, that people, I've seen it a bunch, and I know a lot of my colleagues have, that somebody orders a bottle of wine and wants it served in some way that you just find abhorrent. And the thing to remember is that in the hospitality industry, your job is to be an advocate for and take care of your guest. And so there's really, I mean, unless you own the establishment and you are the sole, you know, the sole employee and don't care about return guests, like, maybe if that's the situation, you do you. But in any other situation, you're actually looking to, you know, trade good for services and make a profit. And so you want to take care of your guests. And being snooty like that is usually not the best recipe for success. That said, you know, people are really passionate. And there's another kind of interesting story similarly. And it's basically this idea of, you know, kind of this cult bourbon shit, as Julian describes it. And the author, I think, is just fairly impatient with how people get, you know, so crazy for Kentucky or for bourbon rather. And so Julian's son, Preston, and the author went out to San Francisco for Whiskey Fest. And so Whiskey Fest, I've not been, but I've been to enough festivals where I know the scene very well. It's usually in some sort of large, like, ballroom or large convention center. And there's lots of stands or displays. And then there's bunch of ticket goers who will come in and taste whatever they can. And of course, there's always going to be the especially lauded producers, and there's just a mad rush for their tables. And of course, that's what happens. So the three of them stand behind their table and they waited for the hordes to descend. Every age of Pappy was on the table in front of us, and the doors opened and the line wound around the whole hotel ballroom. People lined up, they got a small pour of whiskey and a photo and a few words, a photo with Julian. And the first bottle of 23-year-old, and keep in mind, these aren't like full shots that people are getting poured. They're getting poured just a wee tiny bit, right? The first bottle of 23-year-old was gone in 6 minutes. I was counting. Someone asked for the empty bottle. This I love. Preston politely told him no. And when nobody was looking, he scratched the label so that people couldn't find the bottle, take it, and sell it online full of cheap whiskey. And I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, but this is a practice that actually happens with fine wine. Because when you have something that is so, you know, desired and so valued and so expensive, what follows is counterfeiting, right? And so I've had experience where I've been at events where there's, you know, really exclusive high-end wine, classified Bordeaux or Grand Cru Burgundy. And when the bottle is emptied, you have to destroy the bottles, smash them, trash the labels, because there's always a bad actor out there who, if they understand the value and the demand for, you know, the liquid that was in that bottle, might take an intact bottle, put something, you know, that's nowhere close to it in there and try to sell it off to an unsuspecting audience. There have been famous counterfeiters throughout the ages who've done this. And so it was just really interesting to me. Of course, it makes sense. You know, I didn't think about this, but of course, when you've got a bottle of, you know, a producer of bourbon who's selling bottles of whiskey that, you know, on the open market cost $1,000 for a 750-liter bottle, yeah, they're going to have to destroy that bottle. Anyway, 8 minutes later, the second and final bottle of 23-year-old was gone. People would be lined up for hours. And one of the things that's really interesting about this book is that, you know, in that same sort of passage, there are people in the crowd at Whiskey Fest, you know, who run retail stores, liquor stores, or shops that sell wine and beer and all types of alcohol. And they would always fuss at Julian and say, why can't I get more? And he would always kind of counteract and rage about them, how the state liquor boards control the allocations. He couldn't even make sure that 11 Madison Park, a 3-Michelin-star restaurant that had always supported his whiskey since before it was cool, was even able to get as much as he wants. He said it felt really corrupt. And also he would argue back with them because they're the ones who are actually charging the prices. So he didn't control the allocations himself. And then the retailers are the ones who charge the prices. And look, it's a free market. You can charge whatever price you think you can get. But the blame doesn't lie with Julian. But what's also interesting is it's not just Preston or Julian, you know, in the family who's encountering some bad actors. Ed, son-in-law of Julian Van Winkle, tells a story in this book. He's always checking price tags and following up with store owners about the outrageous markups, the price that they're selling the bourbon for. And I don't know where this was, but I'm really curious about this. But Ed says that one time he ordered some Pappy at a bar near a ski resort, and what they poured out of the bottle was not Pappy. They told him he was wrong. He asked to see the manager. The manager asked how he could tell. Ed explained his connection, that he was Julian Van Winkle's son-in-law and worked with him. The manager said he'd check, but never returned. The next day, the bottles were gone. So I want to encourage anyone who is a lover of bourbon and wants to try Pappy Van Winkle to go out there. But just as in the world of fine wine, there's a lot of nefarious and bad actors, and it's possible that counterfeit examples do exist. But here's something that a lot of people who've been following this producer might be familiar with, and it's something called Pappygate. And so sometimes the bad actors are on the inside. A few years ago, a bunch of whiskey went missing from the distillery itself. A loading dock employee stole around $100,000 of whiskey, wait for it, that he worked to sell through a syndicate made up of members of his rec league softball team. That seems like kind of a small town detail, but it's it goes on to be described by the author as a ham-fisted minor league cornbread mafia. Also, they seem to have trafficked in guns and steroids. So stolen bourbon was not the only illicit good that they were tracking in. But that was also one of the things that no doubt led to the increase in the price and the scarcity of Pappy Van Winkle. Because, you know, it's a similar thing, if I could draw a parallel, slightly different, but still involving crime. In the wine world, it happened in Brunello di Montalcino. It's not Brunello Gate like Pappy Gate, but one of the most famous producers of Brunello, Gianfranco Soldera, makes these really, really great wines. Brunello di Montalcino is 100% Sangiovese. It requires long aging. And these are wines that are easily $700-$800 or more, sometimes at cost. And they're beautiful wines. I've had the opportunity to buy and sell and taste them. But an employee, a disgruntled ex-employee, broke into the cellar, and these wines have to be aged for 5 years minimum before they can be bottled and sold. And this employee opened the taps on a bunch of vats of aging Brunello, and it ran off into the ground. And so it's sort of the same thing. Like, these things exist all over the world of really any sort of like fine or luxury product. But it was unique to me to see how there's some similarities and some kind of links between the fine wine world and the fine bourbon world. And how when something gets so deified or rarefied, like, people go to really crazy extremes to get at it. There are some really heartfelt and sweet moments as well. And I mentioned that the author, he gets a little bristled or annoyed with the fetishists, the people at the Whiskey Fest and the people who go, you know, absolutely apeshit for this wine. And Julian's wife, Sissy, kind of gently scolds him and says, you know, you got to understand that people are passionate about this stuff. And she told him a story that gets recounted in this book. And it's a really sweet story. So Sissy, Julian Van Winkle's wife, has long been, and maybe less so now, but for a long time was with him or representing the bourbon at sort of these festivals and these trade events. And she was at Whiskey Fest or a whiskey festival in New York. And there was a guy, a doctor, who brought his father and his friends to the Whiskey Fest. And they really hit it off. And they were talking and laughing as they got to the front of the line. And then later, Sissy Van Winkle ran into him with all of his friends. And he introduced her to them. And they told her that he was the best. And I'm going to bungle this, but he's a doctor, otolaryngologist. Anyway, he's a doctor who works with hearing and speaking. I can't even pronounce that. But anyway, she asked, what on earth did that mean? And everybody laughed. And they were talking. And he said, you know, first of all, they were just talking about, you know, casual things like bourbon. And then later, more like life-like, you know, important things about life. And he says to her, and it's recounted in this book, he says, I feel so strongly that we were meant to meet this evening. Wait for it. So Sissy goes home. And a week later, she and Julian find out that their son, Preston, who was a young child at this point, is partially deaf. Now, 4 decades later, sitting at their dinner table in Kentucky, she began to cry. She cried too then, she said, as she went back into the story. They had exchanged information, you know, when Preston was a little kid and Sissy and this doctor in New York after Whiskey Fest, after they talked, and she found his number. And she called him in New York and she said, I need your help. And she smiled and tears were still in her eyes. And this doctor who was, you know, a doctor who was the best ear guy in New York helped the Van Winkles choose the doctor who operated on Preston to restore his hearing. And now Preston will be the person to carry on the traditions and share them with people like this random doctor who came into their lives and came to get a drink and introduce friends. And so in addition to whiskey being kind of about nostalgia and heritage and tradition, it's also, it brings people together. I mean, certainly you could like sit alone by yourself and drink whiskey, but there are some kind of connections that happen as a result. Now, it's not all just family history and crime. There's some really kind of great family stories in here. And there's a little chapter 21 where the author's visiting with the Van Winkle family. And it was cocktail time. And they're trying to think about what to drink. And look, if you should be so fortunate as to be friendly with Julian Van Winkle, and he says it's cocktail time, I mean, if it were me, I'd be drinking whatever he suggested. And he said, I think about making a Manhattan. Van Winkle, Manhattan, a Manhattan. What is a Manhattan, do you wonder? Well, it's Julian's personal riff on a Manhattan. So the author asks, what is a Manhattan? And he says, it's half rye and half bourbon. But when he said rye, he meant Van Winkle rye. And when he said bourbon, he meant Pappy. He used Carpano Antica vermouth, which is a really nice Italian sweet vermouth. So a Manhattan is bourbon or rye, sweet vermouth, and bitters. And it can be garnished with a twist of lemon or a cherry, depending on what your base spirit is. But a Manhattan, of course, is Julian's riff. He's got equal parts rye and bourbon. Very nice rye and bourbon. Really nice sweet vermouth. And then he spooned in some juice from a jar of Luxardo cherries. So these are like really nice cocktail cherries, not like your dollar jar of maraschino cherries that you get at Kroger. And the author asked, how much of that juice? And he said, I don't know, about 2 teaspoons. I just do it to taste. It's kind of the same with the vermouth. And then he reached for a small bottle on the shelf, 2 or 3 shakes of orange bitters or blood orange bitters, which is what I made this with the first time, and always a twist of orange. That really sets it off. He finished mixing the drinks and he handed one to me and he kept one for himself. We both had a sip. They go down real easy, he said. And I just think to myself, ooh, that sounds really good. I'm a lover of Manhattans. You hear these like fun stories and you just sound so fun. Some of these family kind of vignettes are just my favorite thing about this book. And, you know, this is a podcast of my impressions on this book. And so it's not me reading this book to you, but this one part I feel like I need to read. So if you'll indulge me, it is my podcast after all. It's basically a take on Julian and Sissy and the life that they've created for themselves. And it makes me want to be their friends. This was their life, a perfect drink poured from a found bottle of old school Maker's Mark. The seductive Van Winkle thing is really a series of mostly replicable actions and details and moments. You could live this life if you wanted. That's real peace, I think. They love each other. It's impossible to miss in the way Sissy looks at him across the table after all these years. In the way he always takes the juiciest or best piece of anything he grills and brings it to her on a fork. He's got a telescope powerful enough to see the rings of Saturn. She tends a vegetable garden. Sometimes she'll cut flowers. Both of them read books. Sissy likes to paddle her kayak and do Pilates. Julian swims out to the buoy where he keeps their boat and motors around the lake. Growing up with their kids, their boat was known to everyone as the Go Faster Daddy. All the children in the neighborhood wanted Mr. Julian to pull them around in an inner tube. And now pictures of their grandkids smile from frames hanging all over the house. Long ago, Sissy decided no bunk beds for the kids. They're a bitch to make up, she says. This is where I really start to love it. Julian got a full-size urinal installed with a brass bar above it in case anyone gets a little wobbly. There's also a marble shelf above it for a cocktail. So you can just imagine, after a few cocktails at the Van Winkle summer home, you get a little wobbly, just rest your drink up there and there's a bar to hang on to. He makes his own Kahlua. Sissy plays Mahjong. Julian listens to Alan Jackson. Once their triplets all got arrested for walking under the influence. They thought that was hilarious. The paper printed the infraction. Carrie, Louise, and Chanel Van Winkle from Louisville, Kentucky were arrested. And it's just, it goes on and on and on, but it just seems like the sweetest, most loving family in the whole wide world. And I just loved all of those little descriptors. Walking under the influence and the Go Faster Daddy boat are probably kind of two of my favorite aspects of it, but it's just so incredibly sweet. Kind of the meat of this book is part two, where it's this mix of like family vignettes and sort of history of the world of bourbon. And then part three is just kind of small, and it's more like the current event and the current landscape of things. And there's a really cool and interesting to, you know, whiskey nerds or just beverage alcohol nerds anyway, chapter two, where the author gets to accompany and participate in barrel tastings along with Preston and Julian Van Winkle for their new release that's being distilled and aged at the Buffalo Trace Distillery. And sort of that's kind of moving into where things will be going from here, which I think is really cool. It's just such a lovely book. So what works with this book? I think just about everything. It's a fast read. He's a really great storyteller, and so much about this just seems like a story to be told. But it's this really pleasant mix of both understanding the historical trade of bourbon and different producers of bourbon, and then the history behind Pappy Van Winkle and what has led to its, you know, its status as, you know, such a cult favorite in terms of bourbon, and also maybe why you'd kind of want to join that cult. It has these kind of juxtapositions of the Van Winkles and the Thompson family, and it's all just this beautiful, like sweet, soft, southern, historical, I don't know, story. And it's hard to get a hold of a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle. I don't have any at my house, but you know, I joke a lot with these podcasts that sometimes they're just absolutely made for a pairing. And whether or not you have access to Pappy, if you do, if you have the means, it is so choice. I recommend you pick up a bottle. If you wanted to sip along with something, like however you take your bourbon, neat, on the rocks, perhaps on the rocks with a twist the way the Van Winkles do, it would be a really nice thing, I think, to sip along and kind of think about and taste and just enjoy with this book. As for what doesn't work, not really anything. I mean, I know that this is a podcast about wine books and this is a book about bourbon, but there's some really clear parallels between the bourbon industry and particularly stories and happenstance around Pappy Van Winkle and what happens in the world of wine. I'm a beverage alcohol professional. I certainly love spirits and cocktails. And so it's a great story, but yeah, it's not a wine story. So if you want to take a hard line, then I guess for a wine book review podcast, this is not a book about wine. But it is a fast read. It's beautifully written. It's a great story. I enjoyed this book. I tore through it. It's such a fast read, but I learned from it. And you all have heard me say that before, that I really appreciate when I can learn something new from a book about, you know, what I've made my career doing. And so I do really appreciate that. But it's just absolutely lovely. So for my rating, you need to buy this book. It's just so good. A well-rounded bookshelf if you are a beverage alcohol enthusiast. I mean, you could just have all books about wine, but that would also be like having a cellar with just bottles made from one grape variety. You need a little bit of, you know, a little bit of variety in life. It is the spice. And so it's great, easy, fast reading. It's not a long book, but it's beautifully written. It's a great story. And if you like it, I underlined there's a few other books about bourbon that are referenced in this book. And I like found myself underlining them and wanting to order them. So there's a few other, like, if you enjoyed this, you might like, options for you. So if you find yourself, you know, reading this book and you dig it, you've got some additional reading that's highly recommended to you. So buy this book. It's so lovely. I really enjoyed it. Hope y'all will forgive the inclusion of a book about spirits, but it's a really, really special book. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to subscribe. And if you like what you heard, leave us a rating. Tune in next week. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.